Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Legacy Finance Committee to order this fine February morning. Welcome, everyone. I'd like to start off with roll. Katie, good morning. Would you be willing to start us off with the roll, please?
Good morning, everyone. Chair Lilly.
Here.
Vice Chair Jordan.
Here.
Representative Green.
I think Mr. Green had is excused. Is it?
Representative Acom.
Here.
Representative Anderson.
Anderson here.
Representative Bo. Representative Christensen.
Here.
Representative Hassan.
Here.
Representative Murphy.
Murphy present.
Representative Nelson.
Nelson present.
Representative Erdahl.
Here.
Representative Wasluwick.
Here.
And Representative Zhang.
Here.
Excellent.
Thank you. Sounds like we have a quorum. Thank you for your help, Ms. Hirsch. Representative Jordan, I don't know if you had an opportunity to take a peek at our minutes from the January 27th meeting. And if so, would you be willing to move those?
Yes, I have had a chance, Mr. Chair, and I moved the minutes from January 27th, 2021.
Thank you very much. Any questions in regards to the minutes? Seeing none, no waving hands or anything. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Thank you. The minutes from our January 27th meeting have been approved. So this morning, we're kind of continuing down the path that we did with the last meeting in regards to with our partners in the arts area. And this morning we've invited folks from other funds to kind of talk about the impacts in the last year of COVID and how they've responded with the funds that they receive, and then how they've rolled that out and what they're able to do and not do, and then and maybe just kind of briefly talk about going forward too. But we're going to have many of these folks back again, but it's kind of primarily to talk about just a little bit of where we're at and the impacts of COVID. And some people we're going to hear today have seen surges, you know, maybe the Parks and Trails folks, and others have been hit in other ways, not able to get projects out and running. But anyways, we're all impacted, and so that's where we're going today. Again, thank you, everybody. So today we're going to start out with the Parks and Trails folks, and I believe Ms. Mattson, I think you're gonna go first, welcome. Thanks. From coming up from Duluth. You probably had coffee this morning with Representative Murphy, but welcome, and go ahead when you're ready, please.
No thank coffee you, at please. My house.
I'm on to tea now. Actually, Laura Price is going to start us off this
morning. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Chair Lilly.
Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Lilly, committee members, my name is Laura Preuss. I'm a section manager with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources Parks and Trails Division. Thank you for the opportunity to come today and present on the Parks and Trails Legacy Program and COVID impacts. I'm very pleased today to be here with my colleagues, Renee Mattson and Lisa Barajas. And we will take an opportunity to share some of our legacy work and COVID impacts in each of our systems, and we'll each take turns presenting. Next slide, please.
see you have the race on there, the Bear Grease. So that's neat.
The Parks and Trails Legacy Fund is one of four funds. It's composed of about 14% of the entire Legacy Fund. This focuses on parks and trails of regional and state significance. And this is defined in our legacy plan as really those parks and trails that are larger scale, for example, large land base, they're natural resource based, and they're serving a regional or a statewide audience. The Parks and Trails Legacy Fund is really guided by the 25-year Parks and Trails Legacy Plan that was developed with robust public involvement across the state of Minnesota. The plan includes four main strategic priorities, and this is also guided by the Parks and Trails Legacy Advisory Committee. So I'll walk through these four briefly. The first is connect people to the outdoors. And this strategic priority is really about those programs, education, interpretive naturalist programs, or other types of new opportunities that are seeking to connect people to the outdoors, especially new users in the next generation. Secondly, acquire land and create opportunities. This is really about making strategic and critical land acquisitions that might be important for connections, for example, and trails or other things, or new development projects that might create new recreation opportunities. Third, take care of what we have. This is the idea that we want to keep the excellent system that we have and be able to maintain it in good condition, whether that's through infrastructure improvements or increasing accessibility, and also conserving and managing natural resources and landscapes. And finally, coordinate among partners is the idea that we wanna work well together, providing good information to visitors across all of our systems and promoting a network, a seamless network of parks and trails. Next slide, please. I'll talk some about the DNR system. DNR manages a large statewide system, as you can see on the slide, state parks and recreation areas, state trails, as well as a number of different kinds of trails, state forest recreation areas, and water recreation. The Parks and Trails Legacy Fund, of course, is focused on parks and trails. And like all of Minnesota, DNR had to adapt very quickly to the pandemic, especially because we saw that people were flocking to the outdoors in this time. And you may have seen this in the news or experienced it yourself. But it was really quite dramatic. And what we saw across our statewide system was a 25% increase on average across the whole system for visiting our state parks, as well as a 50% increase to our state trails. We especially saw those trends around population centers. For example, Afton State Park was a regular place where we had a lot of high visitation in other parks in the area. But interestingly, we also saw a very high visitation increase in some of our more rustic parks, in remote locations. Beaver Creek Valley is an example. And perhaps people were seeking out remote opportunities for nature-based experiences. The pictures on the slide here remind us that parks and trails and the outdoors are naturally just a great place for social distancing, where you can still have some community benefits and the benefits of getting outdoors in nature. And whether that's getting out on the trails like the pictures are showing, or setting up and going camping. And with such high use across our system, the goal was really for us to make sure that people could continue these opportunities, getting outdoors, knowing how important that was in the pandemic, as well as working to quickly understand how to do that where our visitors and our staff could stay safe. As an example, we adjusted our campground management. We used new cleaning protocols. We limited or adapted some of our interpretive naturalist programs that brought people close together. We adapted to online tools, we added new signage and more. So there was a suite of things. Specifically related to the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund, as you saw on the last slide, that works to advance those four strategic priorities. And because of some of the changing forecasts, revenue forecasts associated with the pandemic, we had to reduce legacy spending. And we achieved this in a few different ways, always being guided by the 25-year plan. We delayed some projects that were still under planning and design, and that was a way to achieve some of that reduction. We also reduced some of the interpretive naturalist programs and tours. An example of that is we paused the popular ICANN skill building program, especially given that that is a program that requires close in-person contact and interactions. So in sum, as we're heading into the next biennium, the Legacy Fund will continue to play a critical role in connecting the next generation to the outdoors. And we really plan to work together to try to leverage this work so that we can connect new and diverse audiences to the outdoors and hope that it's not just a one-year spike in visitation. Thanks for your time, and I'll pass it to Renee Manson. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Price. Ms. Manson?
Thank you.
I'm sorry, real quickly. I think we're going to hold off on questions maybe towards the end because we have quite a few presenters. So I want to make sure that we give everybody kind of a chance to talk. So so if there are questions from members, we're just going to just hold off just a little bit on that, maybe the end of the presenters. Thank you.
Great.
Ms. Manson.
Thank you, Chair Lilly, committee members. I'm Renee Manson. I'm the Executive Director of the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission, coming to you today from beautiful Duluth, where it's sunny and warmish. All three of our systems did share some pretty similar experiences during this year of COVID, and it's really good to be here today to talk to you about how we dealt with those, because there are a lot of good stories in our systems where we saw increased usage. We also had a lot of park and recreation professionals that shared the experiences that they were having and sought colleagues' input and information as well. So this year it was even more important to communicate across all of our systems, sharing information, learning how everyone was dealing with the impacts and working together closely to address those challenges that everyone was really facing. In Greater Minnesota, we launched a series of forums that addressed the topics that were arising as we were dealing with COVID related changes. Topics in those forums are everything from cleaning protocols, crowd control, which is a nice problem to have, but less nice when you're socially distancing, but crowd control, programming safely, and other issues that were suggested by members. So even within our own systems, there was a lot of really good communication that came out of all of this. On the slides in this show on the right, the parking lot full and the line of cars waiting to get in, that's related to the visitation at Quarry Park in Stearns County. Quarry Park features popular swimming quarries, and the county saw a tremendous increase in visitors this summer, as you might imagine. Capacity, however, was limited to 50%, meaning that the wait times were longer to enter, and there was a lot of road congestion, which you clearly see in this photograph. The Stearns County IT department developed an application, actually, that solved that problem. The wait notification was done using a drop-down menu and a single button click, and the app even calculated the average wait time to get in, so visitors knew approximately how long they were going to be waiting. It also eliminated clogged roads, or at least took away some of the problems of the clogged roads, and it allowed the visitors to do other errands while they were waiting to get into the park. So in addition to creating some really good customer service, it solved a problem. And they found that the parking permits for the park this summer really vastly exceeded previous year's visitation. And a lot of those visitors, 77% actually, came from outside of Stearns County. So that was a really good experience, solving some problems, but also pointed to the number of visitors that were leaving other areas and coming to visit that particular park. Now, my favorite slide is the cute little girl with the big smile on the bench, talking to Santa Claus at a very safe social distance. That beautiful shot is Bertram Park in Wright County. And they found a lot of creative ways in Wright County to solve their programming, still giving everyone the same experiences that they'd had, but just doing it in a little bit different ways. And that's just one example of the creative programming and outreach that were cited across the state and were shared among the agencies. Program modifications like these and others enabled facilities to continue their offerings and bringing new experiences to visitors. But I love that little girl. Outside of those closer in parks that I just talked about in Stearns County and Wright County, Mesabi Trail in my neck of the woods in northern Minnesota has also seen really big increases. Mesabi Trail visitors have seen, visitorship has seen steady increases the past several years, but this year they saw a jump of 10%, and that's with no events being held on that trail, and that generally brings in several thousand more users to the Mesabi Trail in a year. So without that, they saw a 10% increase. So that's another really good story about learning what's in your backyard or what's further away from your backyard and using it. The photo, the little man with the mask there, that's a recently launched campaign that Greater Minnesota did. It was to remind people to get out and enjoy the winter with your mask. It's sort of a tongue-in-cheek promotion, and it had the intended effect. We got a lot of good media coverage on that, and it's just a way to remind people that even though it's winter, it's a great time to experience parks and trails. So mask up and mask out, and we love our little guy. You'll see him in my background here too. But it's been received really well. And then, as Laura had mentioned, addressing the budget effects of the COVID-19 and the related cuts in budgets, we did address our 12% budget shortfall by working with three of our grant recipients who had larger projects, and we reduced their project funding for FY21. Now, those projects are still going to continue. The solution was to make those projects whole during FY22. And because they are quite a bit larger projects, they actually were kind of happy to be able to run those grants over two project cycles rather than just one. It makes the flow a little bit better. And sometimes those projects need a little bit longer runway to get moving. So that's some of the ways that Greater Minnesota has dealt with the challenges and also the good effects, side effects of greater visitation during COVID. And now I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Lisa.
Thank you, Ms. Madsen. I enjoyed your mask out effort. I think that's pretty Thanks. Neat to see. And I saw you at press conference and had some coverage there, it looked like. So.
Yeah, we did. Thank you.
So, Ms. Barajas? I'm not sure how to say it, but good morning, welcome, and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. Again, my name is Lisa Barajas, and I'm the Community Development Director at the Metropolitan Council. And on behalf of the council and our 10 regional park implementing agencies, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to share some high-level observations on the impacts of the pandemic on the Metropolitan Regional Park System. So just as a reminder, the council is the regional organization that is charged with long-range planning and serving as the fiscal agent for the regional park system as a whole. We work closely with our 10 regional park implementing agency partners who own and operate the parks and trails in the 7-county area. The importance of the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund for our system has only been heightened during the pandemic as we work to adapt our services for the residents of our region. Like you've already heard from Renee and Laura, participation rates are way up, and you've probably seen it in the news, afternoon news cycles, or if you were even just out on the trails yourself. We've documented use at a number of our parks and trails facilities, and some have shown more than 200% increases above 2019 use. Our agencies have observed that walking and cycling have seen the greatest increases, especially since that's the easy thing to do. Folks live it, it's right in their backyard. They get out and just need a break from being in their homes. These visitation increases have raised some concerns around exceeding that carrying capacity, that crowd control that you've heard about already at our parks and trails. And it's led to some of that crowding at some of our parks, beaches and trails, especially during the spring and summer months. Many of our park agencies ended up closing adjacent roads where they had the ability to do so in those parkways to accommodate the increased participation and allow for safer use. And as a frequent user myself of the trail system in the Twin Cities, I can say I really appreciated having that extra space to ride with my family along those trails and saw so many other families out riding and walking and walking their dogs as well. I'm sure all of the dogs in the metro area were very happy to be out on the trails with their owners this summer. For our park programming efforts, we had to scale back many of our offerings as well. We had to reduce class sizes to safe levels and adapt and move our outreach efforts to the virtual world as well. The photo on the lower left of this slide here is from Anoka County School District, and that shows some of our virtual park programming efforts that were done. Still trying to introduce youth to the outdoors in different ways, and even when we can't all be together in person. As you've also heard from Laura and Renee, the impacts associated with the pandemic led to a budgeting shortfall with the legacy fund this past biennium. We worked closely with our 10 agencies to reduce our FY21 legacy allocation by that 12% you already heard about. We were looking to minimize impacts to projects wherever possible. And agencies worked to reduce the scope on many of their projects, while others needed to be put on hold until after the pandemic, such as public engagement intensive park and trail master planning projects, where even the activities that they wanted to do, we weren't going to be able to accomplish given the pandemic and social distancing measures. There also were some significant unanticipated costs associated with managing our parks and trail system during this pandemic, including increased use of portable toilets, additional cleaning and disinfecting expenses, temporary signage, road and parkway closure costs, which I think often goes unnoticed, but it does cost money to close a road, and it adds up faster than one would expect. Park ambassador related costs and facility changes to buildings such as changing restrooms and showers to single occupancy use. Thank you for that opportunity, and I'd like to pass the presentation to Renee now to talk about the coordination efforts amongst our partners during this pandemic.
Thank you very much. You're so right. All of you have talked about the increased use. It's been amazing to see that, and all three of your systems. Ms. Mattson.
Thank you. I'll just wrap up quickly here. As Lisa had mentioned, we all have worked together on this, as did Laura. We recognize that visitors to our parks and trails across the state don't know who's in charge of the facility, and they don't care. They just want to experience what there is to do. So we believe that through our continued collaboration and coordination, we can make a seamless transitions where our systems connect and also where they complement each other. This year, we did work together to help develop campground reopening guidelines that were shared with the Minnesota Department of Health and the Governor's Office. That working group included participation from representatives not only from our three agencies and our systems, but as well as the U.S. Forest Service, National Park Service, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. That group was established really quickly and worked really efficiently and resulted in the recommendations that guided the safe reopening of campgrounds across the state. And like everything else, campgrounds saw incredible usage increases this past year. So to that end, we want to keep our new users engaged and coming back to enjoy our parks and trails, and we don't want this increased usage to be a short-lived respite from the devastating effects of the pandemic. So we're going to continue engagement that fosters our close collaboration to ensure new visitors really feel welcome and supported, and then return for additional experiences and enjoyment in our facilities. So that concludes our presentation on how COVID affected our three systems, and we look forward to answering the questions at the end of all of the presentations. Thanks so much for letting us be here today.
Thank you very much, all three of you. Again, we're so blessed to have such an amazing park system in our state, and you're out doing that. I see we have we're ahead about a minute. Representative Acomb, can you, you wanna sneak your question in? My committee administrator is gonna get mad at me, but.
I'll be very brief, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. And thank you to the presenters. I appreciated the presentation, and I appreciated the accommodations you made to deal with the times, the social distancing Santa and doing things virtually. I think that's great. My question for you is about the trail system, both regionally and throughout the state. You talk about so much increased users, and I know I was amongst them. I'm wondering do you look at your ridership to compare with recreation versus using it for transit? And I'm wondering, I think more people are trying to get around, live without a car, especially in the metro area, and just wondering if that has increased due to COVID as well, if people are using our trails more for transit than just for recreation.
Right, that might be a question for Ms. Barajas.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Committee members, we haven't done the full scale use on it, but that's a really great question about the differentiation between recreational use and transportation purposes. We know that we can, we're actually just embarking upon a coordinated project amongst our partners to use location-based data, basically your cell phone data of where you're traveling to help us discern between what are those longer term trips and what look like destination trips associated with work. We also expect that because we had a number of, a number of folks working from home, that there was reduced transportation trips to the office, so to speak, than what we might have otherwise seen over this last year. And we know that from just our metro transit system as well, that we've had reduced ridership there. And folks just not traveling as much that we've seen on the highway system as well. So, but that will be some additional digging in that we'll be doing over the coming year, and I would be happy to report back to you as we have those findings.
Thank you very much, all of you, and please stick around if you can. We might have questions at the end if that's possible. And now we're going to switch over to our water team and hear about the impacts in the clean water funds. And I'm not sure where we're gonna start there, but I'm guessing Mr. Gardner, are you, I'll pass to you.
We're good to go. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's nice to see you this morning. Good morning, everyone. My name is Paul Gardner. I'm the administrator for the Clean Water Council. The Clean Water Council is a group of 28 people. 17 are voting members appointed by the governor. We have four legislators, including we've had Representative Akam for the last 2 years, six state agencies in the University of Minnesota. I suspect you will be receiving or discussing our council recommendations for the Clean Water Fund at a later point in the session. We did submit our recommendations on December 1. I am going to be brief because I don't even have any slides, and then I'll hand over the details to Assistant Commissioner Kessler. I just wanted to mention that the Clean Water Council goes through a year-long process to make recommendations for the Clean Water Fund, usually starting in February or so and ending in December. It's not quite a year. So as you can imagine, we had to run right into the issue of COVID. And I'm pleased to say that because of the WebEx ability we have at the MPCA, we are able to carry on that recommendations process without a hitch. And we actually saw increased public participation. We received more public comments about proposals to the Clean Water Fund than we ever had before. Some of that was because we were online, and part of it was because we sought more input earlier than usual. So we were able to pull that off. I will say it's not ideal, just as your situation right now is not ideal, but we managed to make it work. I did want to mention that there are some silver linings of sorts with COVID. Trends that were happening anyway kind of accelerated a little bit. We were supposed to do a field tour at the University of Minnesota St. Paul campus in June to see crops that are developed for water quality purposes and to develop more income for farmers at the Forever Green Initiative. And we were planning back in March to do that in person. And then it became clear within a few weeks that we couldn't do it in person. So we were able to pull it off with just an iPhone and someone at the university facilitating questions. So we had researchers standing in the field holding up their phone with the crops behind them and the researchers describing particular things. And we had a few glitches for the first 5 minutes, but after that, it worked great, and that actually allowed probably members of the public to see what was going on, and so it was all recorded so we could provide it later. So it wasn't just for those of us who were in the know, the general public could see as well. There also have been our partners and at the local level have also done a lot of online field tours. Pope and Stearns County Soil and Water Conservation District recently did a virtual field day on manure management, which which was great when you're drinking your morning coffee to think about, Mr. Chair. But they were able to use recorded drone footage to show in a matter of 5 minutes what it would have taken all day for us to find out by going up somewhere. So again, members of the public could see all of that. So there are some silver linings there. I just wanted to finish and leave you a teaser for when we come back later. I did hear that members of the committee were interested in hearing about equity as well as how the four funds are working together. I can tell you at least two of the funds have been discussing stuff, Mr. Johnson and I and Ms. Nash from the LCCMR have been talking about where various dedicated funds intersect so that we can show you that those legacy funds and other dedicated funds are working together. So I'll leave that as a teaser. There is stuff going on and we'll be glad to report on it. We are also working on how water and equity intersect, everything from practices of redlining, which happened to put people of color in neighborhoods that had high propensity or a high level of number of lead pipes for drinking water, to women landowners who own farms but don't operate on them, and their potential influence to improve water quality, to the immigrant experience and the level of trust in government some immigrant communities may or may not have, such that they're buying bottled water instead of using tap water. So we're going to look at more than half a dozen issues to see if there are things that we are missing with water policy and water funding. And so we hope to report on that. It'll probably be in 2022, but we're having robust discussions and presentations about that right now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. It's we're excited to hear that you're listening and that you're also, I know some of that stuff you were already doing on your own. So it's, and we can, you know, have that all brought out later, but thank you for getting us off started, and I know you're doing a good work there with the council. Commissioner Kessler, I think you're up. Thank you very much for coming, and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Thank you, Chair Lilly and members. Before I start, can you see my screen?
Yes.
Okay, success. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning on behalf of the Interagency Clean Water Fund participants. So that's six state agencies as well as the Met Council, and we work very closely with the Clean Water Council. I talk to Paul on a regular basis as well as the University of Minnesota and all of the critical partners that we have to execute this work. So I am the spokesperson here, but I am representing work that happens with excellent people across the state and at the local level. All right. So the agencies included here are the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Health, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Natural Resources, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, the Public Facilities Authority, and the Met Council Environmental Services. So I'm here to speak to the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic on our coordinated work to systematically work with local partners toward our shared water quality protection and restoration goals. I'll provide more details, but at a high level, the take-home message is that after an initial shock, which we all experienced, programs and projects adapted. Adjustments were made to accomplish most of the work safely. Shifts were made to alternate and virtual engagement, training and meeting platforms. And as many of us have found in the case of our Clean Water Fund work and other life and this sort of interaction, when we use online platforms, we often are able to connect with more people. And I think this was highlighted by Administrator Gardner. So whereas somebody may not have been able to drive from Grand Rapids or Thief River Falls previously, as long as they have sufficient internet capabilities, we've found that if we connect with them and make sure they get the information, that the connection can result in fruitful coordination. So all clean water partner agencies felt the impact and made adjustment across the areas, including monitoring and assessment of the state's waters, development of restoration and protection plans, and localized watershed plans to help prioritize our investments and implement work towards our shared goals. technical assistance to permit holders, landowners, local governments, and local organizations were impacted, and our efforts to advance science and research to fill critical gaps in need of further data and understanding. So these are the buckets of work that I'm going to touch on. This kind of spans the gamut of work that is funded by the Clean Water Fund. So initially, we'll start with monitoring. In response to the governor's stay-at-home order and the need to understand and assess and mitigate risks, all the field work across cross-state agencies and local partners with Clean Water Funds were paused between March and May. As a follow-up, tasks that involved more than one person, boat work, fish shocking, boat or sampling that includes large nets that people have to pull, were not possible for the entire 2020 field season. So this included work that is led by the DNR and the MPCA and is done successfully in partnership with soil and water conservation districts and watershed districts across the state. So facing approximately a 50% decrease in the field work that we could do, because essentially the biology monitoring was not able to be done safely based on what we knew at the time. We were unfortunately not able to bring on the student workers that we usually hire to conduct this field work alongside us. A couple of the consequences of these impacts are shown on the slide. Specifically, MPCA's continuous flow monitoring data that we work with the DNR to collect. So these are continuous automatic gauging stations across the state to monitor flow that's coupled with pollutant concentrations to develop loads at the outlets of the 80 watersheds and in upstream points. All of those data that were collected between March and May will be coded as estimated and considered not as reliable because staff were unable to go out and visit those locations to do the calibration that is necessary. The other impact noted here is that we missed the opportunity to collect water quality samples during the spring snowmelt. So as you all know, the seasons in Minnesota, which we embrace to do a lot of our outdoor and mental health recreational activities, come with a big flush in the spring. And we try in our monitoring work to get out there and capture the flow and the concentrations at those times so that we can do a good job of tracking long-term trends and changes over time that may be impacted by our spring melt. And unfortunately, that was not possible this year. So this slide highlights some other agency-specific impacts. As you may know, the DNR manages a groundwater monitoring network, and they have made commitments and have set goals to build that monitoring network across the state. And those data are used for things like collection of the geologic county atlas so that we can understand aquifer levels and soil conditions and geology across the state, and the progress in those areas were slowed. Similarly, we saw delayed installation of groundwater monitoring networks in our drinking water source management areas. So this is work that the Department of Ag does to look at agriculturally derived contaminants like nitrate, and includes work to test private wells. And those efforts were also impacted as we deemed it unsafe and people probably arguably didn't want people in their homes. So work that required entry into private homes to do that sampling didn't take place. Ultimately, over time, I think they found ways to test wells outside or to do the work in different ways. But I think that there may be a long-term impact in kind of the willingness of people to participate in that, because if we don't have continuous contact and momentum, we don't know what's going to happen year over year. Generally, safety protocols meant that field work that involved more than one person, I talked about the boat work and fish shocking, was not possible. And as a result, we saw about a 50% decrease in the amount of groundwater and surface water monitoring that we were able to do in our 2020 field season. And as you may know, we are working on a systematic watershed approach where we go around the state to those 80 major watersheds and monitor in a handful of watersheds every year intensively, so such that within 10 years, we have done the monitoring to assess and understand the conditions in all of the watersheds across the state. And the fact that we were delayed by almost half this summer means that that schedule may be pushed back a year, so that instead of a 10-year look across the state, this next version will end up being an 11-year version. The other note on this slide has to do with the Met Council Environmental Services. They do a lot of monitoring in the metro area, and similar to the monitoring work that the DNR and the MPCA lead in Greater Minnesota, their efforts were paused for 3 months for their stream work. And then all river and lake monitoring that required boats, so this is a theme, was deferred for the 2020 season. And so they collected about 60% fewer samples during the 2020 field season than in previous seasons. This is the more details about the example that the DNR provided related to their aquifer water level observation well network. So they have a goal of adding 50 monitoring wells per year. And one of the impacts of the pandemic and uncertainty related to the fiscal 21 Clean Water Fund status back in May was that they made slower progress in filling the gaps throughout the state for adding monitoring wells. And one other note on this slide that while a lot of the field work still requires somebody to go out and test samples, they are shifting towards more automated or continuous monitoring. And over time, they will, if events like this happen, hopefully the impact will be less and samples will still be able to be collected. The next component of our collective work that experienced COVID-related impacts is planning. So coordinated planning efforts to protect drinking water, protect and restore surface waters, and prioritize local investments toward water quality goals happen across state agencies with local partners, and these efforts are very collaborative. And like all of you, we tried to effectively and efficiently pivot to virtual means to accomplish this work, and found that in some ways it worked well, and in other ways, because of lack of broadband or opportunities for real meaningful engagement, it just wasn't a viable option. For example, the MPCA has been using remote public participation techniques with varying degrees of success for what are called watershed restoration and protection plans, or the RAPs, in 24 watersheds across the state. Similarly, the Board of Water and Soil Resources has switched many of their One Watershed, One Plans efforts to virtual platforms. And Bowser noted that for the One Watershed, One Planning activities, that after that shift, they've just seen that things are taking longer. And I think that that's something that's recognized across the agencies, that while you might get more people in the meeting, it's hard to get everyone engaged at the level and generate the collective energy that you feel when you're in the room together. As noted on the last slide, the pace of the Minnesota Geologic Survey County Mapping Program has slowed, which directly translate to a slower pace for development of plans, analysis, maps that rely on those planning or rely on those data. And similarly, at the MPCA, the inability to complete all of our surface water monitoring means delay in the development of the models and the analysis that we do to evaluate trends across the state. And finally, the Department of Health noted that their efforts to collaborate with local partners to protect groundwater and surface water sources of drinking water were considerably slowed. Similar to monitoring and planning, implementation work happens across state agencies in really close coordination with local partners. And these two saw impacts due to the COVID pandemic. The MPCA experienced a slowdown in efforts to address unsewered communities. Technical staff noted that projects that were underway were able to proceed at a generally okay pace. However, they found it was very difficult to generate momentum for new projects. These areas in the state where we have undersewered or unsewered communities involves a lot of legwork and relationship buildings, and things like attending city council meetings and meeting with local government and residents face to face, as we've noted that is the more efficient way to do this. Bowser experienced similar delays in processing easements, which historically has been done using a paper system. They noted that the remote work made it a priority to quickly transition to an electronic system. So over time, maybe that'll be a benefit, kind of looking at ways that we can find lessons learned or silver linings. Bowser also received and granted a number of COVID-related extensions to their local government units who experienced their own delays in the ability to implement grant-funded projects. The Department of Ag noted experienced delays in their work to implement the groundwater protection rule in drinking water supply management areas, or FSMAs. MDA staff noted that restrictions on in-person meetings prevented the formation of critical local advisory teams. And Met Council, who works with the communities in the metro area on water supply issues with using Clean Water Fund dollars, found that the capacity of their local partners to engage with them in that work diminished because of their own impacts at the municipal level from COVID to budgets. So across all programs and projects for Clean Water Fund, partners found that social distancing requirements and a move to virtual platforms created challenges in providing technical assistance to landowners and farmers and hosting traditional outreach and activities and events. Social distancing requirements presented delays and challenges in working with landowners on developing and submitting easement applications. Approaches to connect with farmers on the drinking water supply management areas and other vulnerable areas or areas vulnerable to nitrate contamination had to change. Events were held virtually. They did some direct contacts via phone or mail. And overall, delayed development of new on-farm programs for cover crops. Education and outreach events like field days and on-farm demonstration sites changed significantly, with many field days and other events canceled or shifted to virtual platforms. As Administrator Gardner acknowledged, you know, it is possible to do this with someone's phone if you are able to get the connection and the pictures, but the experience just isn't the same. And the U of M, who receives Clean Water Fund dollars to do research and analysis for many of these programs, noted that their stormwater technology training event was canceled, and they are working to adapt to virtual platforms in the future. And MDA noted that reliance on the virtual meetings slowed their source water protection technical assistance, especially in Greater Minnesota, which I think is linked to the access to broadband. Clean Water Fund dollars are also used to advance areas of science and connect research, fill critical knowledge gaps, and research was another area where our collective efforts saw impacts from the pandemic. Contracting delays and constraints on field work delayed the implementation of the microplastics work plan that was developed by the Department of Health and in partnership with other agencies. You may recall that work plan calls for some elements of microplastics research, kind of understanding the prevalence of microplastics in our surface water systems. That work was supposed to be done in coordination with the USGS and University of Minnesota Duluth. That's how it's laid out in the proposed work plan, and they too experienced their own challenges. It's worth noting that type of research requires very heavy nets and boats, and again, we've noted that those types of efforts are very difficult with the social distancing and safety precautions that are necessary at this time. Similar to Bowser's experience with requests for extensions on grants, the Department of Ag, who is the fiscal agent for the Forever Green work, saw a delay in the ability of that research to be completed by the University of Minnesota and partners. And similar to Bowser's experience, the Department of Ag extended at a no cost the ability for them to do the work for a longer period of time. Travel restrictions and social distancing requirements resulted in delays to the Forever Green work at the U in the lab in the spring and the summer. And so that work is just going to proceed, but at a slightly delayed pace. And delays in the U of M Stormwater Best Management Research Program were experienced because there were fieldwork restrictions and COVID protocols such that they were unable to bring on new students to do the work. And in the fiscal 18-19 Clean Water Fund budget, there were monies made available for the University of Minnesota to complete stormwater projects that were supposed to be done by July 2020. And the final push of that work was delayed, and we granted a no-cost extension in that instance as well. In addition to impacting the way, how we do the work, it's important to note that we were also, especially at the Department of Health, impacted by the capacity and the sheer people available to do the work. As the slide says, there have been times since last March when all of the Department of Health staff who have historically been responsible for the oversight and implementation of the clean water efforts that they lead were reassigned to COVID. And the COVID response continues to be the Department of Health's number one priority, which I think we all appreciate. Because the Environmental Health Division has extensive background and planning for real life types of emergencies and is uniquely understanding of what it might mean to have a drinking water emergency, a spill in the river, and have to figure out what it would mean for that drinking water supply downstream. That division, who oversees almost all of the Clean Water Fund work at the Department of Health, was tapped to lead key elements of the state's COVID response, and those people are for the most part still reassigned. So the drinking water programs are housed in the Environmental Health Division again, and those skill sets match the skills and the needs that we are currently seeing at the state level related to COVID. So managing data, risk communication, organizational development, and risk management. And so, I think we are all grateful that they are doing this work for the state, but it doesn't come without a cost. So in prioritizing the remaining non-COVID activities, the Department of Health notes that they were able to keep momentum going at least a little bit in all of the Clean Water Fund work. So there have been more significant impacts, understandably, at the Department of Health, but they are continuing to do the work at the pace that is allowed at this point. So the last kind of chunk of my time, I just was asked to talk about the impact of the Clean Water Fund holdback. So in addition to the impacts of the COVID, we were asked to talk about a request that we collectively at the agencies received from MMB in May of 2020. The specific request came on the heels of the May 2020 budget forecast and asked the agencies to identify $17 million in potential reductions from the existing 2021 budget. So across the board, that equates to approximately a 7% reduction from the fiscal 2021 appropriation. We understood that this request was made in consideration of the fact that at that point, the sales tax revenues that feed the Clean Water Fund were projected to be much lower. Everyone was staying at home. And to avoid a situation where we would be in a deficit, we were asked to identify areas where money that had not yet been spent could be just put aside or held back. So to thoughtfully and collaboratively respond to that request, the interagency coordinating team developed the guiding principles on the slide. We wanted to make sure that we were maintaining momentum towards the most critical clean water, land, and legacy goals. We didn't want to lose staffing expertise that would then put us behind when we had to rehire and train if we were to lose staff. As you've heard in previous presentations, the Clean Water Fund does an excellent job of unlocking and leveraging other funds, particularly federal funds, when you think about the area of concern or NRCS funds. And we wanted to make sure that we didn't lose those opportunities. And we also wanted to be mindful of other priorities. You heard Administrator Gardner talk about equity, and I think climate is another one where we're all really all in at this point, and we wanted to make sure that we kept those things in mind. So in response to what we've heard from our executive budget officer at MMB, and I think he noted this in testimony recently to your committee, we understand that the holdbacks are proposed to become reavailable to the agency. So for example, the money that the Department of Health and the partners had set aside for the microplastic study that couldn't be implemented could become available in July. And I think it's just important to note that all of those appropriations come with timelines. And in order to really do that work, we need to make sure that we get an extension on those timelines so that we can do the work in the quality and at the pace that it deserves. Similar to the COVID impacts on our work, I just got some examples here of the very specific impacts that different agencies received or felt because of the holdback. For example, at the MPCA, we experienced delays or had to reduce the scope of watershed analysis by contractors in 5 watersheds. The holdback meant less money available for grants, money we put out the door related to chloride, chloride that comes from water softeners, septic system fixes, as well as the Voyager National Park concerted work to address septic systems in that area. Another impact of the delay was in the development of the technical guidance for the iron enhanced sand filter, which is being done in concert with a contractor. And across agencies, we saw that vacant positions were held open, which meant that we had fewer people to do the collective work, as well as really support our local government partners through the technical assistance that we do that really kind of keeps this going. There were funds that were held back in the One Watershed, One Plan grant areas that resulted in fewer grants to local watersheds, which impacted the transition to statewide watershed-based plans and the timeline where we've committed to do this by 2025. Similarly, Bowser held back project and practices grant funds that reduced overall meant fewer number of local implementation activities received grants. There were held back PREP funds that will impact our ability to match the federal funds unless they are replaced as currently proposed this July. And finally, reductions in the Met Council appropriation that they use for water efficiency grants meant less training and less work with their customer communities. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll just say thank you for the opportunity to be here again on behalf of all of these partners on the slide. And there are representatives here today from all of these entities, and we're happy to take any questions you may have.
Thank you, Commissioner Kessler and Mr. Gardner for telling our story on the water area and the impacts. And it is interesting to hear, you know, how the monitoring obviously would be different and the impacts, and then having your health team being reallocated. It is amazing that they have those skill sets, but the higher calling is pretty clear to all of us. So thank you. Yeah, please stick around if you can for questions, and we'll definitely have you back as we move forward and in this session with this bill. You know, putting the packages together. So now we're going to switch to the outdoor heritage piece of our budget, and I have Mr. Johnson and team, and to kind of say some of the impacts that they've seen in their area of work with regards to COVID. Mr. Johnson, Director Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, I'm Mark Johnson, the Executive Director of the Lessard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. Mr. Chair, members, we're fortunate to have 3 of our program managers or coordinators with us today voluntarily. they're wonderful. Greg Hope with DNR, Wayne Osley with Minnesota Land Trust, and also Kathy Barbel. Kathy's the coordinator of the Small Grants Program, the Conservation Partner Legacy Program that through DNR. If it pleases the chair, I'd like to have them each speak, and then I'll come back and wrap it up at the end with kind of some more recent observations we've seen as well. So, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Director Johnson, and I believe Mr. Hoke, are you on deck and ready to go from the DNR?
I am on deck.
Okay. So welcome. Good morning.
Chair Lilly, members, thank you for this invitation today. My name is Greg Hoke, and I'm the Prairie Habitat Supervisor at the DNR. Part of the Outdoor Heritage Fund request that my program submits each year is to support the DNR's roving crew. We currently have 3 8-person crews, and we're developing 2 more crews. These roving crews are solely dedicated to enhancing and restoring grasslands, wetland, and forest habitats. They have specialized training and equipment and to do the habitat projects. Unlike an area wildlife manager and their staff who have a large range of duties, roving crews only conduct habitat work. That's all they do, 40 hours a week. The DNR also has a number of contractors to conduct other restorations and enhancements. Over the years, we've been able to determine what projects are most efficient to do with roving crews and what projects contractors are best suited for. So for instance, in some cases, a project may need a special piece of equipment the roving crews simply don't have, such as a large backhoe. It's more efficient to hire a contractor than to lease or rent the equipment and keep our staff trained up on that equipment. In other cases, a site may be so far from the home base of the roving crew, it's easier to hire a local contractor than to mobilize the crew. Alternatively, roving crews have specialized training and equipment for projects like prescribed fire, which most contractors don't have. Over the years, the DNR and conservation partners have worked well with well over 100 small business contractors, which the following presenters will discuss a little bit more. So last year, we slowed down some work, but it also created some opportunities. The following are a few examples. So some of the issues we had included, because everybody had to drive separately, there were some increases in fleet costs. Especially in the early months of the pandemic, some projects were delayed until specific activities were approved. For a range of reasons, area managers didn't submit quite as many projects to the roving crews as they typically do in a normal year. As we all know, COVID protocols kind of slowed everything down just a little bit. Canceling the 2020 prescribed burn season set back some crew members on their certifications. At least a couple of crew members would have been certified as burn bosses during the 2020 burn season. However, they will be able to make up these certifications during the next burn season. However, on the positive side, crew members were able to complete several fire needs assessments on some of our larger units, especially up in the Northwest. They were able to map fire breaks that they will need to install for future fires in the next couple of years. They were able to spend more time talking to and contacting neighbors of WMAs that we hope to burn this spring. This is an important step for maintaining good relationships with all of our neighbors. They wrote and completed numerous burn plans. Crew members were able to complete a lot of online training and coursework, which they probably wouldn't have done in most years because they would have been out in the field. The crews were also able to get some new equipment and then use that time to get multiple, use that, we'll call it downtime, although it wasn't really downtime, to get those multiple members of each crew experience with and certified on that equipment. So while the roving crews didn't get quite as many acres under their belt as they would in a typical year, they did still get a lot of work done, and we think the work that they did this year is going to make them even more efficient and more productive in upcoming years. And with that, I'll hand it off to Wayne.
Thank you, Mr. Hoke. Those burn crews are super fascinating and do great work out there. And it's many, many good hours are spent out there and at the legislature, many members aren't aware of. So thank you. Mr. Ossley, welcome to our committee and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Hi, Chair Lilly and committee members. I'm Wayne Ossley. I'm the Director of Land Protection with the Minnesota Land Trust. The Minnesota Land Trust is a nonprofit conservation organization with offices in St. Paul and Duluth. We work principally with private landowners using conservation easements as our land protection tool and offering restoration services as well. The Outdoor Heritage Fund supports our work statewide across 11 different program areas, ranging from extreme northwest Minnesota to the southeast, southwest to the, to the northeast, and also the metro. The impacts stemming from COVID-19 cut across virtually all facets of our business practice, and the impacts we feel as land trust staff are also being felt by those with whom we work and those that we rely on to get the job done. In short, projects take more time to complete and are more personnel intensive. We are seeing this play out on multiple fronts, and I'll share a few examples of those. Like everyone else, our staff are working remotely right now. We've had to adapt to the circumstances and address the communication glitches along the way. Coordination between staff and with our partners has been challenging at times. Landowner outreach and project development, which is core to a successful program, has also been impacted. Field day events designed to attract and inform landowners have been canceled. In-person outreach to landowners has been significantly curtailed or eliminated, and this has been especially problematic in our newer programs that are just now getting off the ground. There are no kitchen table discussions with landowners. Although we've developed workarounds, these personal relationships are critical to project and program success. Travel has not been eliminated, but it is more expensive and cumbersome. There's no carpooling, so at times that means multiple vehicle trips to sites. And because we're trying not to stay overnight, work days are longer with more miles per day in the field. Our remote program areas, as a result, have borne the brunt of these travel restrictions. Our visits to these areas have been more infrequent. Our contractors and professional service providers, appraisers, surveyors, title and restoration companies are feeling the impacts as well. Overall, these tasks are taking longer to complete. As well as the timeline for project review and approval by the DNR has lengthened from 2 to 6 weeks during COVID. And standard in-person real estate closings are now completed through the mail. And finally, as a nonprofit, the Land Trust raises private funds to help supplement the funds that we receive from the state through the Outdoor Heritage Fund and other grants. And these private funds have been a little more difficult to raise during COVID, as can be expected. All that being said, there have been some positive adjustments in outcomes. We are seeing significantly more interest in conservation easements by landowners than ever before. And although this has posed some challenges to our staff and professional service providers, this is also great news for conservation. Landowner contributions of easement value, the amount that they actually donate to the project, enables the state funds to go farther, and these have been maintained at pre-COVID levels. We figured out how to adapt to the new norm despite all the challenges thrown our way, and we have done so safely in a manner that protects those with whom we work. Our landowners, contractors, professional service providers, and partners, these individuals and small business owners enable this work to happen, and we recognize that providing for a safe working space protects their health and ensures that the economic benefits of this work to their families and local communities is maintained. Despite the impacts from COVID, the Land Trust is actually on pace this year for a record year, both in terms of the number of projects completed and the acres protected. And we couldn't have done it without the work of all of our partners. And first and foremost on that list are the DNR and LSOAC staff, who have done a remarkable job in keeping the system flowing, from reimbursements to appraisal review. Their work has actually been very impressive and has helped us keep the conservation happening. So thank you, and I'll turn it over to Kathy Barbel.
Thank you, Mr. Ostley. And Ms. Barbel, welcome to our committee, and thank you for coming. And I've always been impressed with the work you do.
Thanks, Charlie. Thanks for inviting me here to speak today. For the record, my name is Kathy Barbel, and I'm the coordinator of the Conservation Partners Legacy Grant Program, or CPL, at the DNR. For those of you that don't know, CPL grants go out to both government and nonprofit entities across the state We have many metro and outstate partners, and nearly all of them utilize contractors to complete projects that are awarded through CPL. The first few months of COVID-19 were very challenging for CPL partners. Many contractors were deemed non-essential workers. The Conservation Corps crew members were sent home, and there were burn restrictions on most state and federal lands. Because of this, several partners requested extensions for grants that were set to expire in June. In the last couple of weeks, I've been talking to our grant partners to find out how projects have been progressing and how their experiences with contractors have changed during the pandemic and what their concerns are now. Some of the larger contractors that our partners work with have struggled to keep their crews fully staffed for a variety of reasons, and this has led to longer timelines for finishing some projects, or crews having to return to project sites to complete some lingering work. This is especially common for our metro partners. Many projects have gotten back on track quickly though. Contractors have been able to get back into the field and get a lot done due to the milder, drier weather that we've had in the fall and early winter. And when contractors do have full work crews, a lot of the work on CPL projects lends itself to social distancing. Many contracting crews can get back into the field without changing too much about the way they work. There are some exceptions, like Greg and Wayne have talked about. They have to take separate vehicles to the work sites, but for the most part, after the initial shutdown, work is moving along as it did before the pandemic. Some of our partners have noted that they expect to see an increase in some of the bid prices because of some of the inconveniences of the pandemic. Separate vehicles, separate hotel rooms, et cetera. But this increase hasn't been realized yet for many partners. Many of our partners utilize the Conservation Corps of Minnesota. And just because of the nature of how CCM works, namely sharing housing and transportation, a lot of CCM crews were sent home during the shutdown in the spring and early summer. This really slowed down some of our partner projects, especially those that use CCM as a primary contractor. One brighter spot for a lot of our conservation partners is that more contractors are submitting bids or requesting to be added to bid lists for our conservation partners. And this is a great sign, I think, for future projects that will be starting soon. There have been some unexpected reasons for project delays among our partners. There are more people using our natural areas, and they're curious about the work that's getting done. And while these interactions are educational and great, and they help the public understand the conservation work that's going on, the volume of people has slowed some work projects. And while this has been a year of challenges for our partners and their contractors, after the initial shutdown, projects have largely gotten back on track. This year saw more than typical requests for contract extensions. But to be honest, every year that I've worked with CPL, I've seen several requests for contract extensions, mainly due to weather or permitting or work schedules. In short, there were positives and negatives that COVID-19 brought to CPL projects, but through the fortitude of our partners, CPL projects have been completed and been successful through 2020.
Thank you, Ms. Farbo. Again, great work in the grant area. Director Johnson, you said you wanted me to pull back to you, and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thanks. Just a couple of comments at the end here to wrap it up. I want to thank Greg and Wayne and Kathy for pitching in here. It's always nice to hear from the program managers what's going on in the field, and that's something that we value as Lasard SAMS staff as well. You know, last year, there were some preemptive steps taken for COVID, and the legislature added extensions to fiscal years of 18, 19, 20, and 21 for appropriations, added a year, I think, to each of those. So that helped preemptively. This year, just to let you know, in our the current recommendations from the council, I think it's House File 88, if I remember correctly, just introduced the other day, we're going to be looking at least 8 other extension requests for appropriations. And to be honest, I think at our next meeting in March, we'll be looking at maybe another 8 to 10 And it's really because the even though our program managers had, many of them had thought as of December that, okay, things are probably going to work out okay. Since then, there's still been tremendous, you know, they found out more, and they've really been looking at things saying, boy, you know, our, because of the weather, that's compounded the COVID type interactions, restrictions, et cetera. So the delays are the number one challenge that we're seeing with regards to COVID. And those delays, one way we can take care of them in some ways is the extensions or providing extensions on appropriations. From a standpoint of stream work, I talked to a program manager the other day who does mostly stream work, and he said the delays they're seeing aren't with getting equipment in there. Getting a big piece of equipment in and the operators is fairly easy to do. Once they get the green light for the permitting and the inspections and stuff from agencies. So part of the bottleneck, as you've heard with MPCA and with the other presenters, has been that agencies have really been under the end of the gun and had a lot of, you know, their funnel has really been necked down for what they can do during these past several months. The, you know, it's not all bad news though, and that is that when the small contractors too and equipment people, once they get their green light, they are getting that work done. And so another reason why we want to continue to use those local contractors. Some other good news is there's lots of interest. Lately, we've been getting, again, lots of calls and emails with regards to how can we apply for Outdoor Heritage funds. And some of those are for the smaller grants. Some are for potentially larger grants from local, from LGUs and nonprofits. The so I anticipate there will be a lot of funding requests again in the spring when we release our RFP on April 1. And we look forward to that being a real robust process. In the meantime, as the bills come before your committee and others in the future here through this session, we'll just kind of keep you and the authors appraised from an extension standpoint if there's other things that come up. Mr. Chair, just again, thank you very much for letting us provide some information to you. And we'll stand for questions if you'd like.
Thank you, Ms. Director Johnson. Thank you for your team, on a side note, giving us proposals. I believe Representative Green received one and I received one. And just so committee members know, we have an extra packet of proposals, and I can certainly get it to your office and you could take a look at that. It's not related to this issue, but it's their upcoming proposals for this session. So we have an extra copy. So if you want to dig in deep, like Representative Green often does, that's available. So we have some questions. We're going to transition into that. Thank you, all the presenters. And we're going to start with Representative Erdahl. I believe you have a question, and go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you, Chair Lilly, and I'd like to thank all the presenters for the information today. I think it's most helpful to us. A question I have probably for you, Chair Lilly, or maybe Mr. Hagemeyer. In the last biennium, what was the total amount of money that was available for legacy funding as compared to the present biennium? What does it look, what does it look like this biennium compared to last?
Right, I think to get the exact number, Mr. Hagemeyer, are you on here? Oh, good. So
there I am.
You could provide that that data. And I know we've been pretty lucky with the impacts on the sales tax, but he can speak to the final answer.
If you can give me a couple of minutes, maybe go to the next question and come back to me, and then I can have it available.
Sounds great. Representative Erdahl, do you have any other additional questions at this time?
No, I don't, Chair Lilly.
Okay.
Appreciate Mr. Hagemeyer coming back to us with the answer.
we'll come back to you. Representative Murphy, I see your hand up in the old-fashioned way. I like it. either way works for me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And in the last presentation that we had on the Outdoor Heritage Fund projects and Lasard Sams, and Mr. Hope talked about three roving crews, and pretty soon we're going to have five roving crews. And Mr. Johnson just talked about the continued relationships and cooperation between the nonprofits and other partnerships. Could you, Mr. Johnson, could you address how you are ensuring us that we are not providing legacy funds for supplanting?
Mr. Johnson.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Member Murphy, that's a really good question. And the roving crews are specific to habitat restoration and enhancement through the Outdoor Heritage Fund. So they would not exist were it not for the funding. This is work that is, all of their work is being paid with the Outdoor Heritage Funds. Anytime if they are used for other work than Outdoor Heritage Fund work, it's paid for separately. DNR does a really good job of that. And I think Mr. Hope can probably get into more detail on that if you'd like, but it's very well regulated and they're following their records really closely. If you'd like, Mr. Hoke, to definitely give more information directly.
Thank you, Director Johnson. Mr. Hoke?
Yes, thank you for the question. So yes, we try to be very diligent about this and not mix things to the point that for all three existing roving crews and the two that we're developing, we don't even house them currently in DNR facilities. They are in their own separate facility. They don't even get to use, you know, the DNR copier or, you know, fax machine that's in, you know, the regular DNR office. They are completely separate. And again, they are, it's all above and beyond what we would be doing without them. They will occasionally get pulled off for things such as if we have a really dry spring, the DNR Division of Forestry may pull them off a little bit for like wildfire response. In those cases, we take them off of Outdoor Heritage Fund, put them onto a separate funding string, and we try to minimize that as much as possible so that they are going almost 52 weeks a year doing habitat work. We try to be very diligent about keeping the roving crew separate from kind of what I'll call, for lack of a better term, kind of the base work or base funding that the DNR does.
Thanks for that clarification, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Hoke, Chairman Lilly. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Any other questions? Representative Zhang, did you have a question?
Well, now that you asked that, Mr. Chair, to the testifiers who spoke earlier, so I'm looking online and I'm checking out some of the New Mexico's outdoor equity program. I know that one of the testifiers mentioned earlier about applying a racial equity lens to the work that we're doing here. If the testifier can also send me more information about it and perhaps share with the legacy committee here on how has the program been implemented and how many people has engaged and how has it impact the outdoors for our communities who often are displaced, who are marginalized, who do not have access to the outdoor programs.
Thank you, Representative Zhang. I heard that topic come up in a couple of discussions. Is one of you that was in the parks area in particular, or was it in the agencies? I know Mr. Gardner brought it up in his introduction as well. any of you want to?
Ms. Price.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, representatives, thank you for the question. Other presenters may have information on this topic, but I did want to share that the Parks and Trails Legacy Advisory Committee has recently put significant effort and emphasis around the topic of racial equity and really trying to get to reaching underrepresented audiences and considering approaches to sort of diverse outreach. And so that I'm happy to share some information from the Parks and Trails Legacy Advisory Committee, as well as the DNR and Met Council in Greater Minnesota are also keenly aware on this and have been trying to work on this in some time. The Legacy Fund is a really important venue in order to be able to do this, or funding source for that. For example, with our DNR Legacy Funds, we use that to enhance multicultural outreach and marketing, as well as really putting an effort towards thinking about what's our intercultural competencies in sort of staffing and the work we do. And so this is really an important area as we seek to have our parks and trails provide opportunities for all Minnesotans and have it reflect the demographics of all Minnesotans. Thank you for the question.
Thank you. I see Mr. Hagemeyer's returned. Representative Erdahl, I believe Mr. Hagemeyer is able to answer the question.
I have more information I can send around to the committee with a chart of what we'd have appropriated each year the legacy funds have been available to, but a very short answer, and it kind of depends on what forecast you use, so it's always a changing number of what the reserves are. But for the last biennium, we appropriated $748,147,000. And as of right now, for based on the November forecast, it looks like we'd have about $763 million available to appropriate for the upcoming biennium, keeping in mind that those forecasts change again in February, and the Outdoor Heritage Fund is typically a one-year appropriation, so we'd be using next February's number for that fund. But I can send more information around to the committee on what's been appropriated each year.
Thank you, Mr. Hagemeyer. That was quick. So we're getting towards the end here, and just a couple things. I want to thank everybody for coming today and presenting, and many of you, we're going to have you back as we move the bills through. You're aware of that, but it's great to hear the impacts of COVID and what that's done in these funds, because certainly it's a different world that we're in right now, and we need to kind of anticipate that. Also, I'm glad Representative Zhang brought that the equity switching topics to our committee generally. I'm just going to say right now that as we move forward, I'm really hoping that we do a better job of really identifying, and we're going to be challenging all of our receivers of legacy monies to step up and to say their story. Many are already doing a great job of reaching over the top on equity, but it's definitely going to be a priority of the Minnesota House and this committee to do a better job to make sure that we're reaching out to all Minnesotans, the people of color, to everyone, to get out and enjoy the fruits of these dollars. And again, many of you are doing great work already, and so those stories will be told. The Greater Minnesota Trails, I think I had that conversation with the director there, and she said they're doing some small grants I had never even heard of it, but we'll have other opportunities to hear that. We have, so hopefully your people are listening. Moving forward, the committee, we're gonna start hearing bills, and if the bills, we have I mentioned this last time, we have a bit of a bottleneck upstairs. We're happy to work off of, just drafts as well. I know that's not always ideal, but in this situation, I'm happy if you have ideas, please get them to the committee administrator, Mike Molzon, and we're going to be moving forward and with draft bills and projects that in these funds that, and then, you know, ultimately get to a full package of all the funds. So with that, I'd like to thank everybody again for coming today and telling the story of the impact of COVIDs and great partners out there doing good work. And again, thank you to my committee. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.